for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The military is trying to improve its treatment of traumatic brain injury and PTSD. The new National Intrepid Center of Excellence is being dedicated today for the diagnosis and clinical care of service members suffering from various complex brain and psychological health issues. Joining me in the studio, Daniel Swerdling of NPR, who has been reporting on this issue of traumatic brain injury and PTSD, and Dr. S. Ward Cassells. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense in Health Affairs. Joining us from a studio at WCVE in Richmond, Virginia, Dr. Gregory Oshanek of the Brain Injury Association of America, joining us by phone from California, Dr. Jonathan Sills of the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. And throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us by phone at 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Daniel Swerdling, I'm going to start with you. I know you have been reporting on this, and you have now seen the National Intrepid Center of Excellence in Bethesda. Tell us your impressions and why this center is an important one.
It's encouraging to have this center, and it's very exciting looking. On the one hand, it's a beautiful, striking building, and I think Chip Cassells next to me helped design it. Lots of glass, waterfalls, very unmilitary, and that was one of their goals. And they're going to bring up to 500 soldiers per year and their families to this center. They're going to use all kinds of cutting-edge virtual reality techniques and the latest in MRI scans to diagnose and prescribe a course of treatment. And that's exciting because it shows that the Pentagon really does care. The top leaders do care about this topic, traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. The troubling questions I have about this center include these. My investigations at NPR and with T. Christian Miller of ProPublica showed that there are tens of thousands of troops who have, perhaps more, who have had traumatic brain injuries who have not been diagnosed. Many of them have not had proper treatment. So when you talk about sending only 500 a year to this new center, that's only a drop in the bucket. Second of all, this new center is not going to really treat these folks. It's going to diagnose them, evaluate them over only 2 weeks, and then it's going to send them back to the military bases from which they came. And one thing we found in our investigation, which was quite troubling, is that many of these bases do not have adequate staff to treat traumatic brain injury. They don't have staff, occupational therapists and doctors who have really been trained to treat traumatic brain injury. So the center is going to send troops back to the bases where they've been having problems. So, you know, yes, it's a great step, but a lot of questions still about
Daniel Swerdling, he's correspondent with NPR's investigative unit. He's been reporting on traumatic brain injury in a series co-reported with T. Christian Miller of ProPublica. Turning to you, Dr. Cassells, considering the shortcomings that Daniel Swerdling has just outlined, how effective is this center going to be in helping individuals with TBI or PTSD?
Well, Diane, that remains to be seen, but I think they're certainly making a good faith effort, and Mr. Swerdling has, held our feet to the fire back when I was responsible, and he continues to hold their feet to the fire, which is a good thing, as we all know. It's not his job to point out the progress, but it was good of him to do so. There's been a lot of progress in reducing the stigma so that soldiers are more willing to ask for help. You know, I was one of those guys myself who wasn't willing to ask for help when I deployed. I was really quite frightened and happened to bump into a really wise psychologist, younger than me and junior in rank, but a great sense of humor. He deployed a bunch of times, and I stuck to him like glue and helped me get through my deployment in Iraq. His name is Carl Castro, and he's one of the emerging leaders in the Army psychology today. So there are some gems in the Army. At the same time, what Mr. Zwerdling says is, I think, spot on. We're still a little bit short on psychologists, psychiatrists, and when you just spend a week or two at Walter Reed or at this new Intrepid Center, fantastic concept and building led by Arnold Fisher. You know, a building.
And you had a role in its design.
My role was to try to stay out of his way. He was an irresistible force. Yeah, I don't know if you've had him on the show, but he's absolutely one of the toughest guys. And, you know, it's like that takes a tough man to take a tender chicken. It took a tough man to put this thing together against some institutional complexity. I won't say resistance, but complexity. But here's the key to answer your question, Diane. If you go through the center and spend a couple of weeks and you get a plan for your therapy, with milestones, and here's where we hope you'll be. The family can then become the champion for the patient. And when you go out to Fort Bliss or Fort Carson or wherever, Fort Drum, you have that piece of paper. You have that guidance. The bar has been set at a certain level. And between that and people like you all, you know, overseeing what we do, I think we can gradually improve care.
Dr. Aswad Casales, he's professor of medicine and public health at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. He's former assistant secretary of defense for health affairs. Dr. Oshanek, let me ask you about brain injuries and how they actually occur.
Diane, good to be back with you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the comments of Mr. Zwerdling and Dr. Casales. Brain injuries occur whenever there is a force imparted to the head or body that results either in a direct blow to the head or what we call an acceleration-deceleration injury to the brain. That is, if you think about the brain being about the consistency of Jell-O, if you shake a bowl of Jell-O, you'll see the motion bounce and the force wave bounce across the bowl. That process involves straining the appendages, if you will, or the arms of the brain cells called axons, and then can cause a tearing of those in terms of the function, or in the case of mild traumatic brain injury, causes a series of changes in terms of how the brain cell handles sugar and oxygen, the two things that it uses, which then results in a dissolving, fairly similar to what happens to a tadpole's tail, a dissolving of that appendage over time. These two processes then result in what's called diffuse axonal injury, which is really the hallmark of traumatic brain injuries, mild, moderate, or severe.
Go right ahead.
Yeah. In addition, you can have focal contusions or bruises to the brain from the brain bouncing inside. We also know that the pressure wave associated with blast injury creates a change in terms of whenever there's different densities, whether it's liver, whether it's lung, even within the brain, we'll see a change in terms of the tissue in those areas as well.
And I gather, Dr. Oshanek and Daniel Zwerdling, that many of these brain injuries are caused by the explosion of IEDs.
Well, the extraordinary thing is, I never knew before I undertook this investigation, is that a blast wave, first of all, you can see it. Troops have told me they saw the wave coming almost like something in a horror film, these ripples coming through the air and through the soil. And those blast waves go through metal. They go through your helmets. They go through skulls. They go through the brain. And here's what this means for the soldiers who come home, based on the soldiers we've met around the country. And at Fort Bliss, where we talked with more than a dozen soldiers, a soldier named Victor Medina comes home. This is a guy who was in a blast a year ago. His speech is slurred. He stutters terribly, which is not a terribly common side effect, but is a side effect of traumatic brain injury. He goes to the supermarket with his wife. He suddenly disappears. She goes looking all over the supermarket for him. And when she finds him, he says, "Hey, when did you get here?" He has totally forgotten that they came together. He used to devour novels. Now he reads a page, struggles to read a page, and then forgets what he said. Or Brandon Sanford, who was in two blasts in Iraq. He had a dog that sniffed out bombs. He used to help his little boy with his homework. Now his son is 10. He cannot comprehend his son's homework. Or William Frost, who got a Bronze Star with Valor for helping save a bunch of Iraqi troops and his major. He was driving one day and realized, oh my God, I can't drive anymore. He just couldn't put it together. He couldn't wrap his brain around what it means to drive. So he gave his keys to his wife. So these, even when you call these injuries mild traumatic brain injuries, you can't see blood, there's no broken bones. This can cause huge problems for years or the rest of the person's life.
Daniel Swartling of NPR, Dr. S. Ward Cassells, Dr. Gregory Oshanik. And when we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Jonathan Sills. He's a psychologist within the VA at the Palo Alto Healthcare System. Welcome back. We're talking about traumatic brain injury as a result of service in the military. We see that many, many troops have come back either with traumatic brain injury or PTSD. Turning to you now, Dr. Jonathan Sills, tell us how the VA goes about diagnosing brain injuries or PTSD?
Okay, well, I appreciate that question. Thank you for having me on.
Certainly.
The way the VA goes about it, at least nationally, is we have developed a broad-based screening, a set of screening measures. So every veteran who comes in, or if we have active duty service members who come in post-deployment, will be screened by our primary care providers or any other providers that they meet with. Upon getting positively screened or identified that there's a possibility that they have been exposed to a traumatic brain injury, they will then be routed for what we call a second-level evaluation. Now, that second-level evaluation is fairly comprehensive. It's done through a specialty care clinic. And with that, it includes a meeting with a physiatrist, which is a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist physician, as well as meeting with social work individuals, social workers, or psychologists. And also, there is a comprehensive interdisciplinary team, which can be brought in as consultants to continue the evaluation. So these evaluations are extensive. They can take up to an hour, 2 hours for interview as well as a medical evaluation. And then as the consultants are brought in, it could take another number of hours. With those consultants, I would add, are psychologists who spend a great deal of time doing formal testing measures as well as interviews to help identify the symptoms that people are experiencing and also identify the potential causes of those symptoms, be it a traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress.
And Dr. Sills, if one is diagnosed, what happens next?
Well, the diagnosis is basically a critical component to our developing of comprehensive treatment plans, and that's really where we tend to focus, at least in the unit that I work in, is how to help people get better from these injuries, from these experiences. So the comprehensive treatment plans could include identifying any type of changes in cognitive functioning. Those changes could be in multiple domains. It could impact people's memory. It could impact people's language, their production, and their ability to understand language, their visuospatial processing, so how they get around and how they identify things in the world, their ability to focus their attention, maintain their concentration. And also another quite important area is what we call executive functioning. And executive functioning are the ability to plan and sequence information, and this is pretty critical for people to go out and do their daily activities.
And then what happens once you have seen that these are the problems? What kinds of treatments are really available?
Well, so the treatments available through our services are basically cognitive retraining, and which is done with a comprehensive team approach. This comprehensive team includes psychologists, social workers, occupational therapists, physical med and rehabilitation.
Okay, and how many people do you have on your staff, Dr. Sills?
So in the staff that I work with here at the VA Palo Alto, we have a very robust system of care, which we call the polytrauma system of care. It includes three distinct programs. One program is our acute inpatient rehabilitation program, which is a staff of 55. We also have a transitional rehabilitation program, which is people that are not as who still are having difficulty but aren't as medically compromised, and that focuses on community reintegration and cognitive retraining. That has a staff of 22, and our outpatient service has a staff of 12, which does primarily assessment and developing comprehensive treatment plans.
Okay, now what I want to do is come back to you, Daniel Swerdling, because as I understand what you said, this new facility is simply going to diagnose and then send these men and women back to their bases.
That's right. And one thing we should make clear, and this is something I think a lot of listeners don't understand, the Department of Veterans Affairs, which Jonathan works with, and the U.S. military are like two different worlds. Sounds weird, but it's true. So there are two systems of care that are almost completely separated. One is the active duty. One is the active duty troops who are still in the military. They're at their military bases and their military medical centers. And then you have the Department of Veterans Affairs hospitals, and Jonathan works at one of the best in the country. There are hundreds of VA medical centers. And if you're a soldier or a Marine or whoever with traumatic brain injury, you will be very lucky if you get to go to the one in Palo Alto where Jonathan works. The problem in the military, in the active duty military system,
active
and this is
duty.
What T. Christian Miller and I investigated, is that from the battlefield all the way back to their military bases, there are failures at every step of the way, which have endured for years now. First of all, senior military researchers told us that on the battlefield, as recently as a few months ago, doctors are not diagnosing traumatic brain injuries. Now, why? One reason is that many of the doctors in the military, surprising as it may seem, have not been trained to diagnose traumatic brain injury. It would be great if there were a blood test, you would prick your finger and it says you do or you do not have TBI, but there isn't, unfortunately. And as Jonathan was was describing, it, you need to be trained. It's complicated to diagnose. And, you know, it takes effort and people who know what they're doing. And many of the doctors in the military have not been trained. You know, they were family practitioners back in America before they were caught up in the war. Number two, some doctors, and I know that military officials get very angry when we say this, but we have been told this over and over by senior people in the military, including senior doctors. Some doctors do not believe, they do not accept that these traumatic brain injuries are a serious problem. You know, they think you get a concussion, you shrug it off, you go back and play football. That's their mentality. And even when they do diagnose, so our study, our investigation showed, based on interviews with dozens of key military people and reviews of thousands of documents, including private emails among top military officials, our investigation suggested that tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people with mild traumatic brain injuries have gone undiagnosed. Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to stress one thing. Most people, the vast majority of people who get these injuries recover spontaneously in a matter of days or weeks. But, and this is the big but that we're worried about, civilian studies, which aren't great, but they suggest that at least 5 to 15% of people who get these injuries have persistent problems which endure for months or years. And since the military's own study suggests that as many as 400,000 troops may have been in blasts and receive concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries, that number, multiply that times, you know, 5 to 15%, you're talking about potentially tens of thousands of people who've gone undiagnosed and perhaps untreated.
What worries me from your statement, Danny, is the extent to which military doctors are not only not trained to recognize these brain injuries, but may not be told to recognize these brain injuries.
You know,
Diane, if I...
Go ahead. Hold on. Is that Dr. Oceanic?
This is Dr. Oceanic. I apologize. The difficulty is not just limited to the military. Study just in the past 18 months at a medical center in the Northwest found that 50% of the time, the diagnosis of mild traumatic brain injury was not made when it would have been appropriate in the emergency room.
Well, help me to understand why. As Danny says, there's no blood test, but aren't there uniform approaches to making this diagnosis?
There are uniform guidelines that are used in terms of diagnostic criteria. The Centers for Disease Control presented theirs first in 2003. They've since been adopted by the VA and Department of Defense. Part of the difficulty, I think, goes back to the training. In emergency rooms where physicians are trained in academic medical centers, the likelihood of folks seeing any quantity of individuals with a mild traumatic brain injury is far lower than the likelihood of seeing people coming in to the trauma level one trauma center with a severe traumatic brain injury. So the physician is skewed in his training and biased unintentionally, I think, in terms of looking at the more severe. Secondly, is I think that there has been a culture of, you know, no pain, no gain. It's just a ding. Go back into the game and play, which we are now learning about more chronic traumatic encephalopathy through the NFL studies and Chris Nowinski's group, things of that nature. So I think part of it is a culture issue, and part of it also is a training issue among my colleagues and physicians.
Your reports, Dan Swerdling, have gotten some response from the Congress.
Yes, some members of Congress are circulating a letter which will ask the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, the government watchdog, to investigate the extent to which the military is or is not diagnosing and recording and treating traumatic brain injuries throughout the whole system. And a member of Congress, Representative Teague from New Mexico, has asked Fort Bliss, which is a base we focused on in our reports, to come up with some answers to some tough questions. He's going to visit the base this weekend, we understand. So there was a hearing the other day at the Senate Armed Services Committee. which was going to focus only on suicides, but as a result of our reports, they broadened it to TBI. So people are starting, I think, to realize this is a serious issue, among others, that is, you know, could cause problems for decades.
One thing I'm particularly concerned about, I think you, Dr. Sills, made this point, that after this extensive diagnosis, diagnostic system, and then some help from your center, that then the family becomes the champion of these individuals. That's putting a great deal of weight on that family, is it not? Once these men and women have served in the military for the government of the United States, now to put this back on the family?
Well, I can speak to that. This is Dr. Sills. I believe Dr. Cassells had mentioned the family, but I would like to speak that we do function in an environment where we focus on family-centered care. And what that means is the family with the injured service member who are our patients, work collaboratively as much as we can with the family as well as with our medical teams in order to meet the overall needs for treating this individual. These types of injuries do have a large impact on interpersonal functioning. The primary impact that will inevitably be with have an impact on the family and the family structure, how they're getting along, how they're getting along together, spending time together. So we try to work collaboratively with the family whenever possible in order to meet the overall goals of helping everybody to manage through this.
Dr. Jonathan Sills, he's a psychologist within the VA at the Palo Alto Healthcare System. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dan Swerdling, you want to add to that?
That one of the troubling things we found at military bases, and we talked to soldiers from half a dozen bases across the country, is that in contrast to what Jonathan is saying about how important it is to have the family involved in the treatment of the soldier or Marine or whoever, that the bases generally excluded the families. And the family members, wives, mothers, told us about, you know, trying to get in there and be with their son or spouse and sort of being blown off by the doctors at the military base. Like, you know, this is not about you. This is about the Army.
Wow. Yeah, all right. Diane, yes, Dr. Oceanic.
Yeah. In terms of family, I mean, there are many well-designed studies over the past 20 years that have shown that basically within the first year, spouses, the wives of injured men, are 50% to 60% of them will have a diagnosable depression or anxiety disorder of their own. We also know that, unfortunately, the divorce rates among individuals with traumatic brain injury are several multiples, 5 to 7, some say even higher times the national rate of divorce. So it is difficult for the family system to accept additional stress in terms of those types of demands of becoming the manager or the champion.
All right, Dr. Cassell, you want to add?
Let me stir this up a little bit if I can, Diane. And everybody on the call is, everybody on the show is obviously got sincere concern for our military. And believe me, as somebody who was responsible for those 10 million kids, I appreciate that. But let me just inject a note of realism. We get a lot of kids, 18, 19 years old. Many of them have not been the teacher's pet. They didn't get along with the boss. They maybe didn't get along with their parents. And they go to the military, and they get a big second chance. And the military takes B's and C's to a large extent and turns out A's and B's. And we got to keep that overall perspective. These kids come out, by and large, stronger, gentler, wiser.
Except when they have traumatic brain injury.
Yes. Now, as Danny Swerdling said, most of them get better, too. And that experience of overcoming injury or illness is also strengthening for them. Now, that that doesn't mean we should do anything other than the best for the kids who've been hurt. But at the same time, I want to emphasize that when you get out of the military or when you come back as an Army reservist like I am, you got to have a job. A job is the best therapy. And shows like this need to be careful that they don't get employers thinking that all these kids are addled in the head. Or
I'm sure that's not the focus of your report, Stan.
No, but it's interesting that Chip mentions something that reminds me of Michelle DeArmon, who is a highly regarded soldier in Iraq. She was in two blasts. She fought for 2 years to get people to recognize that she couldn't wrap her mind around the information anymore. And now she's out of the military after a long struggle for the proper treatment. She's back at her job. She inspects x-ray machines and dentist offices and doctor's offices for the state of Pennsylvania. And one of her colleagues described to us in detail how she can't do everything in her job anymore because her brain doesn't work right. And she was so afraid they would fire her. But everybody at her workplace said, you know what? You served our country. We're behind you 100%.
Daniel Swerdling, correspondent with NPR. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The story of Boudris, how a group of citizens in a small Palestinian village united with Israelis to move the security barrier and save their town. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're going to open the phones now. I ask each of you to make your comments brief. I know there is a great deal of passion and emotion regarding this subject, and we'll try to work in just as many calls as we can. First to Marlene in Perry, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane.
Hi there.
What an honor for me. I also struggle with spasmodic dysphonia.
I'm sorry.
My son was in Iraq for 15 months and directly affected by two IED explosions with shrapnel to his head. My son continues to say everything is fine, but 2 weeks ago the bank repossessed his car. He had been faithfully paying on this car prior to his diagnosis of PTSD. Now, as the mom and the next of kin, I was not able to assist in any way. The bank would not work with my son other than to demand the total payment of the balance. There was no bailout for this soldier. Now, I, as the mom, had no right to advocate on his behalf. I called my congressman, the military, and whoever else I thought could help. My question is, who does advocate for these soldiers?
Dr. Sills.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about the situation with this person, and I'm not familiar with the case other than what was just described. But I think the simple answer to that is we all advocate for the son as a member of our community who served all of us and served his country. I think we all function as advocates in that way. My recommendation would be to please have him come in to his nearest VA healthcare facility, let them know what his background is and what his experiences were, and ask them to help him work forward through what he's dealing with right now.
What about PTSD, Danny?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, there are many troops who have both. You know, they have the brain injury from the shockwave of the blast, and they also have post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, from the terror of being in the blast and the other parts of the war that they've seen and experienced. Unfortunately, Marlene, your story is a very common one. One of the big problems with the fact that so many traumatic brain injuries are not diagnosed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we haven't gotten into this yet, one of the problems with the fact that even many of the TBIs that are diagnosed don't end up in the Army's medical records, which we can talk about if you want, but that means that when a soldier or another service member comes back to the States and they blow their bank accounts, they start behaving irresponsibly, it comes to their command's attention, the command thinks that they're, screw-ups. And the soldier or Marine or Air Force member says, you know, look, I was in a blast. I think I have a brain injury. And they say, there's no record of a brain injury. Stop complaining, you know, suck it up and pay your bills. Well, this soldier can't get it together to pay his bills. I've heard this story over and over.
I hope that your son will follow the recommendation just made by Dr. Sills. Contact his VA office, and I wish you success. Here's an email from Mary Elizabeth, who says, I'm wondering how many soldier suicides are actually committed due to traumatic brain injury and trying to cope with it alone. Dr. Oshanek.
Well, we know from studies that go back even as far as World War I that individuals who have damage to their frontal lobes are susceptible to committing suicide, especially with what's called a catastrophic reaction. That's when the insight and the magnitude of the difficulties they're having finally hits home, and being absent of other coping strategies or support, end up doing something impulsively. It comes back to damage to the frontal lobes. The frontal lobes, as Dr. Sills was talking, is where our executive functions lie, but also is where our impulse control lies, the ability to put the brakes on. And the damage that occurs up to 70% of the time in frontal lobes with traumatic brain injuries, the damage that occurs keeps the individual from being able to put the brakes on, to come up with a plan B if plan A doesn't work, and to be able to take a step back and recognize that this strategy isn't working and to seek something else.
All right, and let's go now to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Beverly.
Good morning, Diane. I want to say hello to Danny, whose work I've admired since we worked on a high school newspaper together.
My goodness.
And hi, Danny.
Hi, Beverly.
Go right ahead, please.
But I've been following his coverage of how our returning soldiers are treated, and I'm wondering if there's an economic incentive to not diagnosing, to not recognizing these traumatic brain disorders because of the cost of treatment and the cost of paying disability.
Dr. Cassales.
Well, not that I know of. Most of the issue here is a cultural one, and that's what Danny's talking about, I think. Changing the military's culture so it's more interested in this whole area, reducing the stigma of asking for help, providing enough research dollars. And when I was there, we put in $900 million of new research for TBI and PTSD over just a two-year period. It was the biggest investment the country's ever made in a single effort. So we certainly have no issue with putting research dollars into this. And there's a lot of good research out there. Dietary, sunshine, yoga, vitamins, plus the traditional pharmacologic approaches, all kinds of new diagnostic tests. And Danny said that, you know, we need better tests for this condition. There's no doubt about that.
All right.
But I don't think there's an issue of people just not wanting to pay for long-term care. I don't think that's it.
But you did focus, Dan Swerdling, on people who had asked for help who did not get it.
That's right. Many soldiers told us that they were, you know, screaming for the proper treatment and found that their, including doctors, sort of blew them off. One example at Fort Bliss is a number of soldiers went to a doctor there, the neurologist. He was the top brain specialist at Fort Bliss. And we looked at the medical records. And in case after case, soldiers who had been in documented explosions, who had all kinds of cognitive problems like the ones we've been talking about, this neurologist would conclude, I think his cognitive problems are mainly due to headaches and anxiety. You know, this neurologist just didn't seem to be able to accept the fact that it was a traumatic brain injury caused by a blast wave, which then people outside the military eventually diagnosed. I just want to say something about what Chip just said. It's true that the Congress and the government, both the Bush and Bush and Obama administrations, have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on national level programs, you know, to research and push this field forward, and the National Intrepid Center is one example, although that was mainly paid by a private individual. But we have talked to many people from colonels to generals who have said to us that in private, there is a lot of discussion and a lot of worry about the huge costs of traumatic brain injury. If the government said every soldier, you know, like the ones we've been talking about today, we're going to go to some sort of intensive cognitive rehabilitation program, they are terribly worried, and they do talk about it in private, about what this would cost the military. So that is an issue that's simmering below the surface.
Here's an email here's an email from Mike in Belleville, Illinois, and I'm sure there are many people out there who are wondering the same thing. He says, why are so many soldiers complaining of PTSD nowadays compared to soldiers who fought in the Second World War and the Korean War? In previous wars, soldiers were totally removed from all outside contacts, no hot meals for months. Unlike present-day soldiers who have hot meals, free contact with iPhones and Blackberries, is there a stronger constitution that older soldiers had, or what?
My wife has three people in her family. Two have died. Another is still living. They all served in World War II. One was one of the commanders of a battleship in the Pacific. The others fought in Europe. They came back changed people, but they would never talk about it. I tried to talk with my father-in-law over and over again about what he experienced in the Pacific. He blew it off as though it were a camping trip. And only after he died did we find an article about his return to the United States that said that he had been in eight major Pacific battles, but they would not talk about it, and this changed their personalities forever.
All right.
Dan, I agree entirely. Sure. My father-in-law was a POW in World War II, and it wasn't until his late 60s that his PTSD was finally diagnosed. Pretty embarrassing, given what his son did for a career.
Yeah, I would like to follow up on that. I've had the privilege of working with veterans of various generations, and I can say that the constitution of the returning active duty service members is just as strong as our World War II era veterans and our Korean era veterans. What I think might be some of the difference.
Oh dear, we've lost him. I'm sorry about that. Here's an email. We'll try to get him back in just a moment. Here's an email from James, who says, I returned from Iraq in 2005, suffered various injuries from a suicide bomber. I was unconscious 4 days, spent a month in Bethesda. They put me back together, sent me home. TBI was never mentioned to me until last week, when the coordinator from the Cleveland VA called and started asking me questions. She wants me now screened for my recurrent headaches, dizziness, balance issues. I never thought any of this could be related, but she stressed they have to check it now. I'm thankful for the additional steps they take, even for those of us who've been out for several years. That's a good news story.
It is. It is. And, you know, it's just so great when there are people out there like the Jonathan Sills and Gregory Oceanics of the world who see that this is an important problem and are treating people.
One of the things we know is that early recognition, early diagnosis, and early treatment lead to early success. If individuals can receive the appropriate treatment after early diagnosis, their likelihood of achieving positive outcomes, returning to work, home, et cetera, are substantial. The ability, even after 4 years, is still there, but it's at a much greater cost and takes a much longer time to accomplish that. So clearly, the early diagnosis and early intervention in terms of traumatic brain injury is critical.
Dan Swerdling, one colonel told you that, quote, if any soldiers have fallen through the cracks, it's because they don't want to go to doctors. What was your reaction and the reaction of others?
Well, I told that to the soldiers, and they just, you know, they were dumbstruck. And they showed me the letters and the emails that they had written to people all the way up their chain of command, the ombudsman at the Fort Bliss Hospital, the assistant director of the hospital, letters to congressmen saying, please come investigate. And I talked to several generals, actually, about this on background. And I said, what do you think about this colonel? And this was the commander of the hospital at Fort Bliss, James Bonchak, who said that not a single complaint. He had not heard a single complaint. And these generals said to me, again, on background, they didn't want their names used. They said, well, either he's not telling you the truth, which would be bad, or he's telling you the truth, and that's bad because it's his job as the commander of the hospital to hear these complaints bubbling around the system. And if the people under him aren't bringing these, you know, cries for help to him, then there's a problem with their system.
Dr. Cassell.
Dan Swerdling has done a service for the country at Fort Bliss. Something wasn't quite right there. If you hear what President Obama says about this and Mrs. Obama, Secretary Gates, Admiral Mullen, Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, Pete Corelli, this is not tolerable. It shouldn't be tolerated. Something will be done about
what
that.
What will be done?
Well, I'm sure that General Schoomaker, the Army Surgeon General, is going to look into it. Lori Sutton.
Who has just resigned.
She's finished her tour.
She was pushed out.
According
to our sources.
Why?
Well, there was widespread unhappiness with her, both in Congress and in the military. People felt that although she was, and I'm saying what people have told us in the military, although she is a passionate, committed believer, a great cheerleader, they felt she was not a good manager. They felt that she didn't focus, that she didn't accomplish very much. On the other hand, even her critics acknowledge that one of the big problems in this, and I'd be interested, Chip, to hear what you say about this, there's at the top, there has been a horrible power vacuum. There have been four people rotating in and out of the Assistant Secretary of Defense slot, which Tripp used to have. This is the top guy in charge of, or top guy or woman in charge of health affairs in the military. Four people have gone in that job in the last 3 years.
How could this be, Dr. Cassells?
Diane, I think the Obama administration's now got a terrific candidate, this guy John Woodson.
But you're skipping over my question.
I don't know how. Of course, I was out, so I don't know exactly, but I will say that this Brigadier General Lori Sutton, a psychiatrist, extremely knowledgeable, worked herself almost to exhaustion, and she's rotating out. She did a fantastic job. Not everybody agreed with her, but in psychiatry, people don't always agree.
And the point I was making was that even her critics acknowledge that no matter what she tried to do, you know, it had to be signed off by the people at the top, and the person at the top is just comes and goes like a revolving door.
What is Congress likely to do, Danny?
I don't know. We should ask members of Congress.
All right, and we'll certainly follow up on this with Daniel Swerdling of NPR, Dr. S. Ward Cassells, Dr. Gregory Oshanek, and Dr. Jonathan Sills. This is clearly a serious issue, which I hope the Congress is going to follow through on. Thank you all so much for joining me. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.